On today's episode, we're going to talk with Shane Hennen. Shane is the basketball coordinator at the Sanford Pentagon in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and the owner of Hennen Workouts. Shane has made a huge splash over the past 18 months within the training industry, not only in Sioux Falls and the state of South Dakota, but across the entire country. Shane has spent a bunch of time in Minneapolis working alongside me and has also spent time in California assisting with NBA pre-draft workouts for coaches like Drew Hanlon and Noah LaRoche. What I love about my conversations with Shane is that every single time we get on the phone or meet up in a gym, we are constantly challenging each other, and today is no different. We talked about topics like bridging the gap between coaches and trainers, different methods of player development, and ultimately the ever fascinating topic of what's a travel and what's not. But before we get started, this podcast is brought to you by Catalyst Training. Located in the Twin Cities in the beautiful state of Minnesota, Catalyst Training has quickly risen as the go-to source for basketball training in the state of Minnesota and is sought out by many of the top high school players and programs, as well as the top college and professional players in the state. For more information on all things Catalyst, head to basketballcatalyst.com. I joked in the trailer that literally anyone can have a podcast in the year 2020, including us, but I'm excited about this. I think that we have a tremendous amount of value to give from the relationships and just the conversations that we're going to have. And so thank you for joining us. I'm excited about this. You know, my name is Reed Osi and I'm going to be your host. Now, before we get started, I do want to say a few things. I am from Minnesota, but I am a diehard Wisconsin Badger fan. Now, before you Minnesota fans quickly turn off the podcast, I want you to hear me out. My journey has been long and it's been very interesting. You know, I wouldn't trade it for anything, but I've had many conversations over the past couple months of how I've gotten to this point of, you know, kind of moved all over the country and worked at the college level for 7 years and now work with quite a few pro players in the summer. And people have asked how I got to this point. And I began thinking about that. When I was 19 years old, I worked a basketball camp at the University of Wisconsin. And that's ultimately how I fell in love with the Wisconsin Badgers and the state back in about, I think it was 2008, 2009. And, you know, it's funny because I look back on that time and Jared Berggren was playing at the University of Wisconsin as well as guys like Jordan Taylor and Mike Brusewitz and John Luer. And I look back because right now Jared Berggren works alongside me with Catalyst and I work with the rest of those guys that I mentioned. But the most influential moment was not meeting those guys. It was a lunch that I had with Howard Moore, who's an assistant at the University of Wisconsin. And for those of you that don't follow college basketball that closely, Howard Moore is currently on leave at the University of Wisconsin. He was in a tragic car accident this summer, and his wife and his daughter were tragically lost in the accident, and Howard and his son survived. And Howard has had some health struggles as he's gotten back, as he's trying to get back on his feet. And so, you know, if you watch a Wisconsin game, they have, you know, I think it's do more, be more, four more on the back of their warm-ups. And that's obviously to honor Howard and his fight and just show the family that they are standing with them. But I think back to that lunch conversation that I had with Howard. I was a 19-year-old punk trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I remember asking Howard questions like, what should I get my degree in? What should I get my master's degree in? And he was very honest with me. And after bouncing around a couple ideas, he looked at me and said, Reed, you know, when you need a job reference, when you need your current boss to help you get the next job, you want that boss to be able to say, Reed never told me no. And that literally has stuck with me. Reed never told me no. as a student assistant working at places like University of Northwestern and St. Paul and Bethel University, it wasn't uncommon for me to show up to an 8 a.m. class in a suit. People would wonder, you know, people would ask, why are you in a suit? I said, well, we had a game last night and something happened with the film. And I haven't gone home yet. You know, I kind of slept on and off in the office or, you know, whatever it may be. And I never did that, you know, so it was, hey, look at me. I'm the junkie. I'm the guy that, you know, is just in the office all the time. I did that because of Howard's advice. And Howard in that one meeting, really showed me, what it looks like to have a, you know, a really strong work ethic. And I would attribute that conversation to a large part of the success that I've had, because it's been based on my work ethic. And so, our prayers, my prayers are out to Howard and his family, as he makes his recovery. So as we get started, we're going to get into our conversation with Shane. You know, I think Shane Hennon is incredibly bright and I think you're going to enjoy this. So without anything more, here's Shane Hennon. All right. I'm on with Shane Hennon. Shane, thanks for hopping on with me today. You know, when I look back at this, we connected, I believe, because you sent me an Instagram message when I asked for rebounders working with my pro guys. And I was thinking back, I remember asking you where you were from and you told me Sioux Falls. And I immediately thought, yeah, this guy ain't coming. But you did. And I knew very quickly that you were going to make a splash in the industry. But I could also tell that I think we were wired pretty similarly, which I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not. But I don't know very many people that get up at 3:30 in the morning to drive 4.5 hours to meet a coach that you've never met before. So I know you've had a lot of stuff going on in your life in terms of moving job-wise. Give us a little bit of breakdown on kind of what you're doing now and how you've gotten into the training industry.
So right now I'm actually with the Sanford Pentagon. That's out in Sioux Falls. Sanford family has been really good to me. So the Pentagon is a massive facility in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. 9 full courts, an actual arena court where we host D1 games and all sorts of stuff. So I'm out there running the basketball academy, just doing programming camps, all sorts of awesome things. Been in South Dakota since 2015. Graduated from Morningside and just kind of moved straight up there. It's about an hour drive from Sioux City to Sioux Falls. Just been doing training ever since. Got introduced to the AAU games and the travel coaching and all that stuff. So did that for a couple years and was just doing training on the side and just kind of fell in love with the training stuff. And I did see that Instagram post. And I was kind of at that point where I just wanted to learn more. I just felt like I've watched every YouTube video, all that self-research that you do when you start. I just felt like I did all that and I was just kind of stuck. I think I maybe was following you for 3 days when I saw that. I literally That's just funny. Followed you and you posted that and I sent a message. I didn't think anything was going to come back. I looked at the next day. Didn't have anything till 4. So I was like, all right, we're going up. Got back right after your workouts and had a couple of mine till about 7, 8 that night and then started over the next day. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
I remember, you know, I think you helped. I was doing stuff in Champlin, Minnesota at that time. I had I think I had pro guards coming in with like Nate Walters and Quinton Hooker, Anthony Tucker at 8:00. And then we went to the bigs. And I thought, okay, you know, we're going to do this. We'll have some high school guys. Hey, you want to go, you know, grab something to eat at like noon? You're like, I can't. I got workouts. And I'm like,
I got to leave.
Okay. I'm like, this dude drove 4.5 hours to do workouts and he can't even stay for lunch.
I thought it was good. I mean, I remember leaving there and I was like, I don't know. There was a lot of stuff that I was just like, I don't know how to do that stuff, or I don't know how to teach it. I understand why it's important. I just don't know it. So, and I think I came up 2 or 3 more times.
Yeah.
But after I left that, I just like, that was like a whole new book to me of how to train and how to teach footwork and stuff. And it was super exciting for me because I'm a, I just like to learn new things and just kind of
Yeah.
continuously learn. So that was super exciting for me. But yeah, Nate was there. He was a great dude. We had that big session, and I think you had a kind of a youth high school session right after that too. It was good.
Yeah. No, you talk about wanting to learn, and I think that you and I are very similar from that standpoint in terms of our upbringing. You know,
Yeah.
what's the population of Minnesota?
Well, 1,500 probably,
Yeah, well,
2,000.
that's 3 to 4 times bigger than Rossé, Minnesota, where I grew up.
Right,
But kind of growing up
right.
in a farming community, there's a respect of kind of for the process and hard work and wanting to
Right.
do a good job. And I think that we're very similar that way. But you talked about like opening up a new book. My story being a college coach for 7 years, when I moved to New York City and I started working at a place called Fundamental Sports Training on Long Island while I was looking for coaching jobs, I thought it was going to be easy. And I became obsessed with guys like Paul Pierce and Joe
Right.
Johnson because I'm like, these guys can't move. Paul Pierce is 52 years old and he scored 25 points last night. He can't move. How's he doing
Right.
it? And I just became obsessed with the footwork. And so that was definitely a big part of the learning process for me. I want to, we're going to kind of jump all over today, but there's a discussion that the two of us have had a lot. And I want to go over this. Personally, I think you agree with this, that there's a disconnect between trainers and
Yep.
coaches. And I know at your role at the Pentagon and what I do, we deal with a lot of coaches. And don't get me wrong, we have a ton of great relationships with coaches. But, what do you think causes that disconnect?
I think it's on both sides. I think the trainers have something to do with it, and I think it's partly on the coaches. I do think that the trainers are some sort of perspective. You see a lot of stuff on social media, and you might see a couple of clips of somebody do something crazy, and you kind of think that's what everybody's doing. And the other thing around with the trainers is I don't think we try to, as much as we should, connect with these coaches and just hear their perspective. I also think, it's not really a coach's job, a head coach's job, to dive really deep into skill development. They're just, it's not what they should be spending their time on. They have a lot of other things that they need to master. And as a trainer, you need to understand the concepts and how the game flows and stuff like that. But we have the ability now to watch this stuff in slow motion and to see people's steps and how they move and where their shoulders go. It's like, you guys, I mean, we could study this stuff for hours and hours every single day. And that's what a lot of people have done. And it has really taken the game into a different level. It's taken training to a different level. And if I'm a coach and I don't spend as much time on that, you might fall behind on some of that stuff. But I just think it's on both ends. I mean, I do think coaches need to do a little bit better job of reaching out to skills guys and trying to create a relationship, because I do think skill guys can really help a program, and I've seen it. But yeah, I think it's kind of both ways.
No, I definitely agree with you. And to your point of, coaches not really diving into skill development stuff. I coached at the college level for 7 years and was around four really good coaches. And when I started the skill development stuff, I realized I didn't know very much because, and a lot of that was our time was limited. I
Right.
worked a couple years at the scholarship level, NAIA and Division II NCAA, but for Division III, we're not allowed any time on the floor in the off season.
Right.
So the time that we do get, we're not spending a lot of time on, like detailed skill development stuff. It's more like, catch and rip to the rim. And having worked with a ton of professional players, they talk about, their college experience at a Power Five school. It was like, hey, grab the ball at this chair and rip and go to the rim. And there was no detail. It was just, hey, get there in one dribble and figure it out. And so I do, while high school coaches have access in the summer and have the ability to work with teams, I do understand the point of, hey, your time is limited, your resources are limited. That's where I think this is going down another rabbit trail, but having good assistant coaches
Yeah.
that can kind of overlook that, and have the ability to run that. So alongside that, I want to talk about you know, we talk about connecting with coaches and from the training stuff, you know, there's a lot of junk out there. We would be foolish to not, you know, to not admit that. I think there's a lot of trainers out there that are trying really hard to be good, but their stuff is kind of questionable. So what would you say to a coach? Because that's what I get a lot of times. Coaches are like, well, yeah, well, what about this? And I'm like, well, okay. What do you say to a coach when they approach you about, you know, maybe a guy that you don't think is
I just think I just think that it's either and you and I have talked about this before, it's just so black and white. It's like either you're training like this or you're training like this, and not a lot of people are doing in the middle. So either you're breaking down like the micro skills with and you're using tennis balls and all sorts of stuff, which is not bad. Otherwise, or on the other end, you're just doing all game actions where it's coming off a pin down ball screen, all this stuff. I just personally think you need to be able to teach both. Like I need to be able to break your feet down, but I also should be able to put that in a game situation. I don't know. I mean, a funny story, local high school coach actually reached out to me, and I told you this, but he wanted me to, he asked me, he goes, what are you doing at 5 a.m. tomorrow? And I was like, nothing, coach. I'm just going to be sleeping. And he goes, you want to work me out? And I just like got that text and I started laughing. I was like, yeah, let's do it. And, you know, I was laughing because this has never happened. And I've never had a coach.
How old is this coach?
I would say
mid-30s.
Yeah, mid-30s. Yeah. He's not too old. He's pretty young still. But he's like, he's an old school guy. He's a great dude, but he's an old school guy. And he's seen stuff on Twitter. He's seen all my stuff. And we've had conversations about it. But I get there, we start working out, and he just really wants me to put him through my stuff. Like, he just wants to see what I do with a kid. And we did it, and he did pretty good at stuff, and he also struggled at some stuff. And the stuff that he struggled at, he recognized, like, hey, I can't turn this ball this way and bound. Like, I can't cover any ground. I'm taking too many steps. So we talked about efficiency. We talked about limiting dribbles, like, all this stuff. And we had a conversation afterwards, and we're talking about Twitter, and he goes, you know, there are some times I wish people would post, you know, players that struggle with this stuff. But now that you've put me through this, I can kind of see why you would put somebody good up there or somebody that's really skilled. Cause you're just able to showcase how efficient you are. So I don't know. I think when coaches talk to me about that stuff, I try not to obviously bash anybody, but
yeah.
I just think everybody's got their style, and there's a reason they have their style. They obviously believe in it, and there's, you know, there's a specific trainer or style for everybody. And, you know, there's some kids that they need to be broken down like that. Like, they need the tennis ball stuff. They need all that stuff. Yep. And then there's pro dudes or all sorts of guys that just need reps at coming off a ball screen and just playing. So
I think it's funny that you talk about bringing, you know, going and working out that coach, because the other morning I'm working with Joe Rozga, who played at Denver and is going to head overseas here shortly, and we're working out at St. Thomas Academy in St. Paul, and their head coach Jason Burr said, hey, you know, he's going to open up the gym, but if he's going to open up the gym, he kind of wants to get some cardio in and go through the workout. And so we're talking through this, and, you know, he works with Team Tyus, is Tyus Jones's team in the summer, and we're talking about all this stuff, and you were talking skill development, and I want to kind of go back and forth here, but, you know, being a coach and having my dad as a high school coach for 20 years and now doing the training stuff, you know, I feel like I'm stuck. You know, as a trainer, I personally try to not speak in absolutes as much as I can. You know, like, that's right, that's wrong. Number one, because I want players to make decisions. But I just don't want them to be robotic. And at the same time, if I tell you, hey, Shane, this is wrong, you might not ever realize why it's wrong, but you're never going to do it again. When the next time down the floor, that might, what I just told you was wrong might be the right thing or exactly what you needed. But I'm having a conversation with Coach Burr, and they're talking about some of their ball screen stuff. And, you know, he's like, when we get this action, like, say we reject a ball screen and we attack to the baseline, the backside player is automatically doing X, Y, and Z, right? Like, they have that scripted. And so we've had this conversation as a skills trainer. I'm like, we got to have as many options as we can. I want to go over things. Michael Lancaster's quote of a good habit is a bad habit when it's your only habit. Like stopping left, right is a great habit. But if that's all you can do, you find yourself in situations where you're held hostage by this quote, good habit. But yet I do understand high school coaches and even college coaches say, no, like we're going to script this. This is what we do. What would you say to that? And I know we've talked a little bit about jump stops versus, you know, speed stops. That's maybe one example. Talk to me a little bit about that.
I think, you know, going back to kind of what you were just talking about, it's, you know, from my perspective, what from training these kids and in pro guys or whoever it was, the more skilled I can make them, the better player they become. So there are times we work on specific situations, but you know, Trayvon Evans was here last year, USF graduate, and Sioux Falls here. He's in Germany now. I mean, as far as what I could teach last summer, felt like we went through almost everything. And he
was in the gym all the time with you.
Like he wanted to go, he would do three times a day if he could. But from just looking at him, you know, giving him more options, it doesn't necessarily mean he's going to use every single thing all the time. It's just that he has such good control and demand over his body, his hands, his feet, timing. He just understands it. So especially when we're training, if I can put him in a situation where things are a little bit difficult or if I can layer things, like, you know, I even stole that drill from you, that continuous bound series. Like you bound to the right, go downhill, stop, bound to the left, go downhill, stop, and then get into a finish. Like, obviously, you're never going to do that in a game, but it's like mic and drill or any other continuous drill. You're just trying to make a situation hard and see if they can stay on balance and change direction and finish and all sorts of stuff. And I even had a clip of that series or of that drill, and I cut out the beginning where there was no bound series. It was literally just him at the end of it when he was going to the rim and finishing. And then there's a game clip of him doing that same finish. And then I showed the full clip of the whole drill, and it was like he's doing all this stuff before the actual finish, but he did the same finish. So, you know, he might not pull everything out, but he's pulling those little characteristics out. So I just have noticed the more skilled players become, the better they are in any situation. I'd still like, it's hard because I do believe that there's some players that you need to develop some sort of a role. Like you need, if you're going to be a ball, I mean, you don't want to be average or good at everything and not really excel in one or two things that are going to, you know, get you on the floor. So I do know a lot of kids that are great at working out that aren't, they're average shooters, they're average finishers. They haven't really spent more time on one thing, but I don't know if that is always the trainer's job. I do think that a trainer should inspire and teach them how to teach themselves and teach them how to work themselves out. But a lot of that stuff, I tell kids all the time, but a lot of that stuff kids should be doing by themselves. They should be getting up those game shots all the time by themselves and trying to develop themselves as a shooter. But I mean, that's kind of my viewpoint on that is the more skilled they are, the better player they become. And I've seen it where these kids become skilled and they just kind of take it into their own ways. Like they all have their own style of playing. I do post up stuff with guards. I do big or guard stuff with bigs, and I don't expect them to always do that stuff, but they use it when they can, and it just kind of comes out naturally that way.
No, totally. You know, you talk about that continuous bound series. You know, as a trainer, we're looking for efficiency. You know, we can go down this road and be here for 2 hours, but talking about what's game like, you know, what's the purpose of you and I going in the gym and us both going to one basket, I shoot and you rebound?
Right.
Right? Like, you're there to rebound so you can get the ball back to me quicker so that I can get more shots up, right? Like, I know that sounds incredibly, like, silly and simple, but that's the purpose. Otherwise, you'd go to one end, I'd go to the other end, we'd shoot, we'd take 6 seconds to chase down a basketball, and we go. Like, at the end of a workout with, like, Anthony Tucker or you know, one of the pro guys I work with, like, we can get 100 threes up in, like, 4 minutes. Like, it's crazy. Now, it helps that he makes 90 of the 100 threes and it's coming right through the net. But like, we're striving for efficiency. So I get coaches that will respond to things on Twitter or Instagram that are like, well, this is not game like. Well, do you want me to just do like, and we do this, but like, let's do a single bound, like hopping laterally to the side, landing in a stance where you have options, and then we go. So we bound, we take one shot, and we get three reps up in a minute. Or can we work on body control? Can we bound? Can we explode? Can we stop? Can we get to a second bound and then go? Like, there's game characteristics here. And so while we're trying to make these kids more skilled, we're striving for efficiency. Like, how do you get more reps up? Like, that's where, like, all these, it's so funny to me because I get, like, parents and coaches, because I do a lot of my stuff in small groups. Number one, I believe that that's a better training atmosphere and a better learning atmosphere than a private session. I also don't have time for these private sessions, but they're always concerned about, like, well, am I going to get the same amount of reps up? Like, yeah, then don't complain about the multiple bounds and things like that. And on top of that, you know, we talk about, like, what's the coach's role? Like, you talked about, like, players need to have a role. Like, if your role, like, Morningside, where you went, right? Did I see something that they're, like, number one in the country?
Yeah, yep.
So, let's say Shane Hennon, at your age, with your current athleticism, goes there. Okay? Or me. What's your role? You're like, okay, don't give up a bucket. Reverse the ball, maybe shoot it when you're open.
Exactly.
Okay, that's your role. Like, you can understand and acknowledge that. But coaches are still going to be like, Shane, you got to get your butt in the gym in the summer.
Yeah, you're right.
So what are you supposed to do? Are you literally just going to run from spot to spot and, like, set screens and then catch the ball and throw it off the wall to yourself? Right. Like, no, that's stupid. So we need to acknowledge, too, that the coach's role in helping establish the player's role. You know, we wrote the film room, we wrote a blog on that. Like, players, like, coaches need to be honest with players. Trust me, I get it. It's difficult. And I also understand it's not black and white. Like, I'm talking to players, and I say this all the time. Like, listen, Shane, if I ever get a call from your coach, and your coach says, hey, I told Shane to do this, and Shane said, well, my trainer Reed said to do that, I'm like, dude, I'll smack you.
Right.
Like, we're not doing that. You got to listen to your coach. And I can also acknowledge that there's a lot of trainers out there that are going, hey, Shane, listen, your coach sucks. He doesn't know what he's doing. You got to get buckets. Like, I get that.
Right.
But I also want to acknowledge the coach's role.
Yeah. And I think, I just did this preseason training with a school out here. And, you know, we were working on, I don't know, it was a low post moves or something like that. And we were doing, like, post hooks, and their best player asks me, I look over and he's like, can I shoot it like this? I was like, you can shoot it like that, but the rest of these kids are not allowed to shoot it like that. And I think that's hard for a coach to tell people that, especially in season, to tell a kid that he can't do that, but the best player can. But the thing is, there's a reason that kid can hit that shot. And it could be whatever they worked on in the summer, but as far as roles go, I think that's huge. And I remember at Morningside, I had a dribble limit. My bigs had a dribble limit. There was one or two guys that could dribble more than three or four times. But, you know, we looked at the stuff that we did in the summer. I was dribbling all over the place. I mean, I was going through cones. I was doing all that stuff. So I in my head, I never questioned that. I just thought, okay, we're working out. I'm trying to just become better, and this stuff will just naturally translate to my game is anyway. So, yeah.
Totally. And I think from a coach's standpoint, establishing some of those guidelines and rules, you know, I think parents get involved, and as coaches, we try to be somewhat as vague as possible. You know, I watch Cambridge Isanti is a school in Minnesota, and they have a kid named Henry Abraham that is unbelievable. He's like a 5'11 guard, and he's scoring like 49-50. He scored 50 the other day and had 13 threes. Now, you got a role guy on their team. What are you going to do, tell Henry that he can't shoot that pull-up three in transition? The guy's going to be like the all-time leading scorer for big schools
right
in the state of Minnesota by the time he's done. Like, he's scoring 50 points on 23 shots or whatever it is. Like, you can't, what are you going to do? Have another guy go, well, I want to do that. Like, that's not how that works. I also, one of my closest friends, Chris Vanderhyde, who's an assistant at Gustavus Adolphus, was the girls coach at Park Center in high school in Minnesota, and they won two state titles in his first 2 years there. And he talked about not wanting to have rules. It's like, we don't have specific rules because, like, Shane, you're different than I am. And, like, right. I don't necessarily need to say, hey, we're not doing this when, no, Reed, you shouldn't do this. But Shane, absolutely, go do that. And kind of establishing a culture where, hey, we want to win and we want to be successful. If you're not going to buy in, then you got to go. Right. So I understand that can be... That can be a slippery slope, but I don't want to go too far down that because we'll get stuck there. Jump stops versus speed stops, our favorite topic. So before we get into this, a speed stop would be referring to, say we're going to our right hand, we're going to stop left, right, an inside outside stop. If we're going to our left, a speed stop would be right, left, which is the quickest and most efficient way to stop. So, Shane, I see a lot of coaches. I talk to coaches. I'm a diehard Wisconsin Badger fan. Jared Berggren works with me. Berggren played at Wisconsin, worked with Brad Davison, Joe Hedstrom, Jordan Taylor, John Luehr, Mike Brusewitz, everybody.
Yep.
They jump stop everything in practice and never do it in games.
Nope.
Ever.
Nope.
Sorry if I just stole all your thunder, but
no,
take it away.
I want to preface this with jump stops are useful sometimes.
They are not wrong. Yes,
exactly. Absolutely. I'm not a hater. I do think they work. And I will say Wisconsin was doing a lot of jump stops in their warmups and in their shoot around stuff. They were doing also, I mean, they were jumping into space, like almost like a pro hop. But they're also just doing the natural jump stop too. So I'm sitting courtside, literally could not be closer to the game.
Let's backtrack. They were at the Pentagon.
Yeah, it's my fault.
So you had access to shoot around and all that stuff.
Yeah, so they were at the Pentagon for 3 days. I saw two shoot arounds, a warm up, and a full game. Everything before the game was jump off two, land on two. And it wasn't, Wisconsin doesn't do normal jump stops. They jump pretty high and land on two pretty strong. So I'm sitting courtside, can't get closer to the game at all, and everybody's enjoying this game, and I'm just literally staring at people's feet, waiting for Wisconsin, even St. Mary's, waiting for a jump stop, and I think I saw one, and it was on a step back or something like that. It wasn't like they were going downhill.
Yeah.
What I did see all the time was somebody is running, like literally they're running side by side, stride for stride. And the best way to get somebody off their hip was just to slam on the brakes 1-2.
Yep.
And then step through and make a pass. Now, I understand that if I jump stop, I really haven't established a pivot foot. And that's really good in some situations, especially youth basketball. That's huge because you don't need as much separation because kids are just kind of flying everywhere. But if I have somebody that's so skilled and quick, if I have no ways to slow down or stop and I'm jumping into space instead of just slamming the brakes, I'm really not going to create a passing angle for anything or separation for a shot or anything like that. So, you know, the other thing too is I'm at a coach's clinic and I'm not going to say anybody's name, but there's coaches that are teaching a lot of jump stops and I get it. And the drill was this, they're at the top of the key, they rip, or they split catch or rip, whatever he was teaching, and they jump stop on the block. So they're literally almost jumping from the elbow to the block. Then they land on two, they pivot. Let's say I was going to the right side, land on the right block. They would pivot on their right foot and then pass the corner. And in my head, I'm saying, that's never going to happen because there's just not enough time for me to jump stop, pivot, and pass. I'm going to have to do that on the run.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to have to just dribble and kick. And, so I look back that night because I'm just like weird like this. I YouTubed three games of their film and it's on YouTube and I count and I saw one jump stop, one useful jump stop out of three. out of three full games, and that was both teams. That wasn't just that team. The other teams I was watching, same thing. And it was girls basketball. So, you know, I think coaches, it's so easy, and just anybody that doesn't dive super deep into skill stuff, it's so easy just to buy into, like, I don't want to say cliche, but just like simple stuff, like, yeah, jump stop, land on two, that's the best way to do it. But that's not the stuff that their players are doing. I mean, they're a lot of those guys or women that, you know, like I said, are coaches and can't dive into it. They want to make it that simple, and it looks good in a drill at practice if I'm doing a weave or some sort of passing drill and everybody's laying on two and stuff like that. But it's just really not happening. That's not actually translating. So I would challenge or even have conversations, or even that coach that worked out with me, we actually had a conversation about this. I would say, I would challenge you, just the same way you challenge me, I would challenge you to do stuff that's actually happening, and to your drill should replicate or try to replicate what's going on in the game.
Oh, totally. As we talked through this, you talked the jump stop. You know, you were with me this summer, towards the end of the summer, and I think it was Jake Lehman from the Timberwolves, Jordan Taylor, yeah, who plays overseas. I think Ryan Brueggemann was there, and Brad Davison. And I love, like, Brad's the best. Like, yeah, I had him go through a footwork pattern, and then I gave them the opportunity to be creative in their finish. And Brad, like, did, like, a box jump without a yeah, box and landed onto, I'm telling you, I know you were there. It was like when you accidentally bite the fork when you're eating, yeah, or you, like, scratch the fork, like, nails on a chalkboard. And I looked at you. Do you remember what I said when I looked at you?
Yeah, yeah.
It was like, I think I just tore my both ACLs watching that.
Oh, yeah.
It was so funny. And, like, we looked at, like, I remember Jordan Taylor, who just, like, goes off the rails. It was like, what was that? And but that's what they're taught. And he knows that because he was the point guard at Wisconsin for 4 years. But right, we talk about, like, basketball myths. And, like, jump stop versus speed stop. But that Gannon Baker put out an excellent video a couple weeks ago talking about a speed stop, a 1-2 stop. Like, you get two breaks. Like, I love that. Like you get to be able to stop left, right. If you want to get to a jump stop's not wrong. But, again, you need to understand the purpose or the situation. Like, if I'm trying to get away from somebody that they're on my backside, like, yeah, I can jump stop to space. Like, I can replace my feet forward, but if I'm trying to stop and create some separation by that defender overrunning me, I create that separation and I just jump into it. So it's obviously counterproductive. Now, we got a ton of other myths, like dribble below your knee. Like, what? Right. Like, when do we right, dribble below our knee? That ball lives at our hip. You know, back in the day, and, like, I think Michael Lancaster, too, posted something about, like, Bob Cousy being the greatest ball handler of all time. And thought, like, well, that's crazy. Like, no way. But Bob Cousy wasn't allowed to put his hand on the side of the basketball. So he had to dribble below his knee and run around full speed, true, like slapping at the ball. But
that's crazy.
So think about that. That's where that terminology comes from, like dribble below your knee. But that, like, that's not the game anymore. The ball belongs at your right, hip. And right, so, you know, I laugh at that because that someone was taught that, you know, when they were in third grade by someone who was also taught that in third grade. But when that person was in third grade, if you dribbled between your legs, it was considered cocky and you got pulled out of the game. And I don't think that basketball exists anymore.
Right. Well, and you had a post about this, just the shooting myths. And I love the shooting myths because, you know, as a shooter, I always felt like I had a couple, like, I just felt like I had different shots. Like my one dribble pull up, my release and my elbow and everything was not the same as when I was just catching and shooting.
Correct.
And I would practice different shots. Like, I would practice being in triple threat and the ball coming from the center of my body, the coming from my right hip, my left hip, almost down by my knee. I would do all that stuff. And to this day, I do believe, like, me putting myself in uncomfortable shooting positions made me a better scorer and a better shooter, just because I was a more skilled shooter. I wasn't like, I need to shoot exactly like this, otherwise I can't make it.
Oh, totally. I think you and I had the conversation the other day about coming off of a pin down, and I'm left-handed. Yeah. And so if I was coming off of a pin down from, say, the corner, everyone always put me in the right corner. Well, you can step right, left, and swing. Like, well, the most important part of your body to get squared to the rim is your elbow. Yeah. If I'm coming right, left, like, my elbow is to half court or the left sideline. So I always wanted to be in the left corner so I can catch the ball. Ideally, I mean, I can even be squared to the right sideline and my elbow's to the rim. I can shoot it that way. You know, so yeah, you talk about like being able to shoot it different ways. Like people would say all the time, like square your feet. Like why? Well, so you can square your elbow. And I'm like, why don't you just square your elbow? Like squaring your feet, like Klay Thompson squares his feet. Now he turns in the air when he shoots it, but Steph Curry starts, his feet aren't squared. Like Kyle Korver can be pigeon-toed. Like you're talking the best shooters in the world. Like get the ball off the palm of your hand. Why? So it comes off your fingertips. Well, why don't you just make sure it comes off your fingertips? Because Curry and Klay and those guys, they all shoot it on the palm of their hand. If you have a kid that naturally sets it in the palm of his hand and he pushes it, well, yeah, then and he shoots a palm ball. Well, then we can fix it. But if he gets it to his fingertips, there's no problem.
Well, the thing is with like all those sayings, like, and I've heard them all forever. And they're just so easy to say, like, hold your follow through, flick your wrist, put in your finger, like all that stuff. You just, it's just so easy to just say that stuff. But I don't, and you were talking about, you were working out with a high school kid and trying to fix his shot. But it's just like, I could sit there with a high school kid and that can't shoot and just say those things. That doesn't mean he's going to get any better. Like, totally. Am I really breaking anything down, figuring anything out, or am I just saying things to him?
Totally. No, I mean, I think there's so much of that stuff, and I think we both acknowledge that, like, it's really difficult for coaches. Like, you know, we're going to teach a jump stop because we just want everybody to jump stop. Or, hey, don't throw a one-handed pass.
Yeah.
When, in fact, like, we have to be able to deliver those
super
passes.
Super necessary sometimes,
I spoke at a youth clinic. I'm like, we teach this, like, two-handed chest pass from the middle of our sternum. Now, someone come guard me. Well, they obviously stand right in front of me. It's not a video game glitch.
Right.
Like, I can't throw the ball through you. And everybody laughs. And I'm like, but we wonder why these youth kids can't pass the ball.
Right.
That's the only, like, no one-handed passes. It's like, well, yeah, they can't reach around anybody. They turn the ball over. So it goes all over the place.
And you told me a while ago you had those youth kids.
Yep.
And I was like, well, what'd you work on? And you said under dregs and all this stuff. I was like, you did that with that, with those kids? And you're like, yeah, why not? And I had a kid yesterday, a fourth grader, that was just extremely skilled. Like, he was just good.
Yep.
And then I had another kid that just wasn't. And we did the exact same thing, but it was just so much more beneficial to that kid that couldn't do that stuff. And I struggle with the youth kids on what to work on sometimes because you want them to get the basics and stuff like that. But
yep.
It's easy to teach those jump stops and stuff like that, but if imagine if a kid like that could stop 1-2 or could just grow up learning that like early on. It's just like, to me, that's such a head start because you just see these, or even with the shooting stuff, you just see kids, you know, in high school or even college that they can't do basic stuff or what we would call fundamentals.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree with you. And I think we get caught in this idea that there's a natural progression for youth players, that we need to treat them differently. Like, no, they're not ready for that. I remember that conversation that you and I had. You say, you got them to do under drags. That's what he means by that is step left, right. So you're staggered, your right foot's forward, and you pull the ball back underneath your leg. And you're like, wow, I can't believe they got to do that. And I'm like, well, dude, they sucked at it. Yeah. For a long time, but we kept working through it. And actually what I did was I kind of made it more difficult before I made it easier, and they figured it out. And I think, like, we spend all this time like, hey, we got to walk through things. You and I both know, and we talk about this a lot, timing is crucial when it comes to your dribble step and, you know, timing everything up. So when we walk through things, I think we obviously were messing with that timing. It doesn't add up. Like, well, I can't walk through it. Like, yeah, duh, because you can't just, the ball's not magnetic sticking to your hand. We got to figure out, we got to walk through this stuff, or we got to go through this stuff quicker, full speed. And I want you to trip and fall 10 times and maybe 100 times until you get it. And so for me, I don't train youth players any differently. It's the same game. It's the same timing. Like, obviously, I'm not going to bring them through the same stuff that I'm bringing Jake Lehman through or Anthony Tucker, you know, one of these super skilled guards. But it's the same game.
Right.
And so I know that you, kind of going off that topic, you work with a lot of really talented or a lot of really skilled girls.
Yes.
And I, you know, I work with youth programs, I work with high schools, and what I find is fascinating, and I understand where the question comes from, but like, well, how do you train girls? How do you teach them? And I'm like, the same way I train a guy, exactly. The exact same way.
But you know what, too? I tell my girls that, and they love, like, they really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Like, I know girls are a little bit different than boys. Girls, like, always want to just make you happy as a coach, and they want to do exactly what you say, and they don't want to go too far out of the box. They also don't want to make a mistake in front of you. I don't want to say every girl, but that's just what I've noticed, is they're almost like perfectionists.
Yep.
And they don't want to... Getting out of the comfort zone is a little bit tough sometimes. And that, to me, is probably the most important thing, especially for girls, because
yes,
there's nobody, and DJ said this, DJ Sackman said this, there's two or three girls in the whole entire world that can play above the rim. If I play a pickup game, even in my men's league, there's a chance when I go up to get a layup, somebody could slap it off the backboard.
Yep.
In a girls game, that's just not happening. But there's an unbelievable amount of like block shots happening.
Yeah.
So he's saying these, you know, girls need to become better at finishing extended. There's a lot of women players that want to finish kind of right by their ear, right by their forehead.
Totally.
And this whole summer, we've been doing this footwork stuff and this finishing stuff. And I've truly been, once I set the tone with, hey, I'm going to teach you the exact same way, I'm going to push you out of your comfort zone. We're not just going to get reps up just to get reps up. We're actually going to try to, you know, become more skilled and a little bit better. And I'm going to teach you, or I'm going to treat you just like the boys. They really respected it. They loved it. So I do think the girls' game is a little bit different, but I don't believe in training them any different than a men's player. So.
Oh, totally. I'm, you know, being from Minnesota, Rachel Banham from the University of Minnesota. I think she's with Connecticut now in the WNBA. And, you know, I've seen her around the gym here, and I think she scored 60 in a game, and Kobe like hit her up and stuff. It was so fascinating. She's the greatest player. You know, you got Lindsey Whalen and some of those in there, but arguably the greatest player to ever play for the Gophers. Mm-hmm. And how people talk about her, they're like, she plays like a guy.
Yeah.
And like, that's a compliment. Like the way she moves, they're like, wow, she's so like, she plays like a guy. Like, right. you're like, what? Like, so if that is the way to compliment her, why would we train them any different?
Train them any different, exactly.
Totally. And so that's where you go back and forth with some of that stuff. I had a girl, Elena Polanco, who I worked out when I lived in New Jersey, and she plays at Wofford. And, like, she's, like, 5 foot nothing. Like, she is, like, super, super tiny, like short, petite, super strong, but she'd go play. Even after I left, I would watch her on DJ Sackman's Instagram clips. Like, she's giving like these guys buckets in one-on-one. Like, Elena's like 5 foot nothing, and she's just super skilled, plays like a guy. I'm like, no, she doesn't play like a guy. She plays like a basketball player. Right. Like, just because she's fluid and can move does not mean that she plays like a guy. She plays like a basketball player. And so, yeah, I mean, I think ultimately you got to train them the same way. Last thing, you know, and I would love to have you back on to talk about this in greater detail. I recorded a podcast on the ever fascinating topic of what's a travel and what's not. I saw, and obviously we're recording this in advance, but today is the 1 year anniversary of James Harden's epic double step back last year, where he picked the ball up, jumped off his left, landed on his left, pushed off his left, landed left, right, and got called for a travel. I think, you know, when we can't go into great detail on this. I think the traveling rule is not as black and white. I think there's a ton of gray area in it. And I think Harden travels sometimes, but a lot of times I don't think he travels. Give me kind of your thoughts on the culture of Instagram and Twitter officials.
Yeah. I think that whole video blew up of Harden. I think it just like, you saw those like videos of people like, they put him, I don't know what he was doing. He was like dancing across space when he was stepping back.
Dude, I did one. I had a kid this summer do like an underdrag and he did like 42 step backs and hit a half quarter and the thing went nuts.
Yeah. So I think that was probably a big, I don't know. I think that move and that thing really sparked this whole conversation and it just been crazy since then. But it's just confusing. I mean, and I think it's not just us as fans, coaches, trainers. I think even the referees are a little bit confused.
100%.
And it's almost to the point where if it looks weird, you call it. And if it looks smooth, you don't call it. I don't know. It's at this point, I think it's really hard to tell what's going on. We talked about the other day that a long time ago, Corey Brewer got a steal or an outlet pass or something, and he dribbled like once or twice. Yep. The ball is floating. What I mean by floating is like the ball's rotating in his hand while he's running, and he's just letting it float. And he took, I don't know, six steps underneath the ball, but then he dribbled again and then got a layup.
I don't even know if he dribbled again.
So he just went right into his layup.
Yeah.
But he never secured it. Like, he never put two hands on it. So he's technically has never established a pivot foot. Technically, he still has a live dribble. So is that a travel? I have no idea. It's really hard. And if you go by the rule book, you're right half the time, but then you're wrong the other times.
Well, to go off of that, and obviously we're talking about at the professional level, the Corey Brewer example, Dellavedova like 4 years ago had one where he went baseline and did the same thing and then made a pass without dribbling. It took like seven steps. But it's like, well, it's a travel. It's like, well, he still had a live dribble. So, well, it's a carry. But he didn't dribble again, so you can't get called for a carry unless you dribble again. And so, like, what, like, and I understand it. Like, if a guy does that, it's like the same as you running up and down 94 feet, like just tapping the ball back and forth in between your hands, mm-hmm. like, hey, I'm bobbling it. Like, I don't have control. I get that. It's like, okay, blow the whistle. But what I think is funny is, like, the question of the summer, and I ask all these people this, is, like, DJ and Alex Bazell working with Carmelo this summer. I think you know the video I'm talking about. He goes step through. Yep. And left, right, I think he lifts his pivot foot.
Yep.
So he jumps off his right foot. And like, they're arguing about it. Well, according to the rule book, you're allowed to lift your pivot foot, take a step, and shoot it or pass before your pivot foot comes back down. That's the rule. Yep. But they call that in the men's game. What they don't call is a standard layup. You dribble, you pick the ball up on your left foot, you step right, left. You're like, well, that's the pivot foot landing again.
It's
like,
literally the exact same footwork.
That's literally, and I talked about in greater detail, if you listen to the first podcast, was like the rule book does not discriminate against specific rules. I even had a guy the other day say to me, he goes, well, and he works with high-level AAU team, like high-level, like shoe circuit. Goes, well, I don't even know how a Euro step's a legal move. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, like we're in the gym. His son is an NBA player. Like, he steps, dribbles inside his left foot, steps right left to Euro. I'm like, dude, shoot a regular right-handed layup. Dribble inside your left foot, step right left, shoot a layup. I'm like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Like, it just proves, and I kind of kid because, you know, I get it. It depends on when he picks the ball up, but it's funny to me because I'm like, that's literally the same footwork.
Yes.
Like, sorry, he stepped laterally instead of forward with his first step.
I had a clip of a kid doing like a spin move. He dribbled on with his right hand with his left foot.
Yeah.
And he spun back to his right shoulder and went right left layup. So I don't know if it's I have girls that do this a lot or even younger kids.
Yep.
When I tell them to do a spin, they'll spin and they'll take that first step, but then they won't put the second one down and they'll do like a twirl, like just jump and twirl and finish.
Yep.
And I'm like, you know that you can put that other foot down and jump off too. And technically, if I do this right, I can spin and sell that shot fake and then step through like an up and
yes.
under.
Yes.
That's 100% legal. Now, I had this conversation with another guy and we were talking about it, and he actually called a ref, a Big Ten ref. And his explanation was, if I'm going into my spin and I dribble with my left foot with my right hand and I spin to my right shoulder, if I were to pick that ball up while I dribble with my left foot, then that is my pivot foot.
Yep.
But if I spin and I let that ball float and then my right foot hits and then I grab it and then I go left foot, I'm good.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, okay, so if I do a layup and I just go one dribble on my left foot, pick it up and go right, left layup, 1-2 layup, that's a travel. And he goes, no. And I was like, what?
And you're like, dude, that's the exact same thing. Yeah. I had very similar a spin move. I post on Twitter. I had a guy who does Division II games who is like a really good buddy of mine. He's awesome. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't think I'm going to call it, but it's a travel. And I'm like, it is not. I actually took the NCAA's rules video. I had it sent to me. Like, yeah. And one of my coaching buddies like, yo, I need your take on this because this doesn't make any sense. I start breaking down the footage and I post it on Twitter basically on a step back making – it's like, that's fine if you want to call that a travel. But if you're going to call that a travel, this layup by Trae Young that no one in America is going to call a travel is now right. A travel. And I had a Division III coach that's won a bunch of conference titles tell me – he's like, Reed, I sent that to our assigner. And said, I think Reed's right. Or like, this doesn't make sense. I need answers. It's like so funny. And it's not the fault of the officials.
No.
It's like the NCAA. Like, they're like, okay, when he picks the ball up, and it's a freeze frame. When he picks the ball up, he's established a pivot foot. And in the video, the guy hasn't picked the ball up. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, see, this is his pivot. I'm like, he has a live dribble.
Right.
But ultimately, you know, like the James Harden stuff. It gets viewed as black and white.
Yes.
Again, it's just like anything in life. Like, we just pick a side. Well, it's the Harden, it's the double step back. Is it a travel or is it not? I'm like, I don't know. You got to show me the clip.
Right. And that honestly is probably becoming my biggest pet peeve as far as any sort of debate goes, is just either 100% this side, 100% that side. And we talked about earlier with being a trainer. I am not like, there's certain kids that need this and there's certain kids that need that, but I got to be able to do both. And in these arguments, it's just, that's the part when this whole like thing went crazy this summer, is just, that was the part that bothers me, is like, you know, it's just a little bit different every time. It just depends on the situation, where the ball is, how he picked it up, all that stuff. It's just different.
Yeah, no. And my favorite is when I get somebody on Twitter that will like not read the caption or anything and be like, yo, bro, just so you know, to travel. Thanks, man. I click on your page. Like, I posted a video of Anthony Tucker, wins an MVP in China. You know, Tuck, like, Tuck's a walking bucket.
Oh yeah. And Tuck probably has the most or the best timing. And as far as what I've seen, best timing and best control of his feet. Like, if he were to do something, I'd be like, okay, that's probably illegal because it's stuck.
Yeah. Dude, so this guy comments, doesn't follow me, doesn't take the time to look at anything else on my page, thinks that I am Tucker.
Right.
He's like, you want to be Hooper? And I'm like, I would love to be Anthony Tucker. I would love to be
that
Tucker.
That would be great.
He's like, man, travel, carry, this sucks. So it's funny. So whenever I post a video of Tuck, Tuck's like, bad shot, toed the line, travel, carry. Like, he just rips on himself.
Right.
Like, just to be funny. But I love it when it'll be some guy that doesn't follow me, that doesn't have a single basketball post. It's typically a guy that's like shirtless in 75% of his photos that doesn't have anything basketball, that's like, you suck, you don't know what a travel is. Like,
it's hard to let that stuff go. It really is hard.
Oh, I know. I just want, like, and we'll be honest, Shane comes at me a lot and says, can you please go Ruthless Reed?
Yep. Hashtag Ruthless Reed.
Hashtag Ruthless Reed, because he's like, you have to have some tweets drafted up on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, dude, go to your drafts. Close your eyes, click one and push send.
Pick one.
I'm kind of bored in Sioux Falls. So, like, I responded to a guy the other day and he and he like cussed at me, and because he like laughed at me and told me I was a joke, and I'm like, oh, you want to have a conversation? I'm more than willing to talk. And yeah. I took a screenshot and sent it to you. I'm like, this is your fault, Shane. This is your fault. You encouraged this. Now we're in trouble.
What was that tweet that you saw yesterday that was about like seeking advice?
Oh, it said something like, never accept criticism from somebody you wouldn't ask advice from.
Right, right.
I love that.
I love it too. And it's just, I don't know. It just, I think it plays well into what we were just talking about as far as people coming back at you. Not even willing to have conversations or in any argument, just not willing to have a balanced conversation about what's going on and stuff like that. But
oh, totally. I'm with you on that, but I'll be honest, it's tough to let go. I think, you know, I've referred to DJ Sackman a lot because I spent time with him for, you know, 2.5 years in New Jersey, and I think he's phenomenal. But he comments to people, he just says, thanks for watching.
Yeah.
He's like, what are you talking about? He's like, I have a film guy. And now, obviously, we have different businesses, you know, online training and different platforms. So, but he's like, I have a film guy that I pay to edit film and from workouts that's free. I'm putting out free content, working my butt off to post free content for Earth, Wind, and Fire 72 to comment on how it's a travel.
Yeah.
When they look like they've never even watched basketball, according to their page, they have never watched basketball.
You know what I noticed too is a lot of criticism or a lot of hate or anything, it usually comes from somebody that probably has not studied or put enough as much work as you have as far as what your field is. So I do think that there's some sort of insecurity with a lot of people. If I don't understand something or if I haven't spent time trying to learn it, it's easy for me just to hate instead of accept the fact that I don't know what I'm talking about.
Totally.
And that's with a lot of things. And I've seen that in the training world where it's like people cling on to that word fundamental because they don't really know to teach how to stop 1-2 or drag or skip step or any of that stuff. I don't know if it's they can't learn it or if it's just they haven't put the time in to do it.
Yeah.
And you go back to that beginning when we first started talking about me coming up to the cities, I literally was in that position where, and I'll be honest, like I didn't know a lot of that stuff and I would look at it and be like, God, I don't know how to teach that. So let me just go this avenue and say, well, we just need to do game reps and less details and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it was easy because I could cling on to that. That's what would have made me successful. And I'm super grateful that I took that trip because like I said, it's opened a whole new world. And to me, I just feel better. Like I feel more confident in what I'm doing and stuff like that. But I do think there's a lot of people that are unwilling to, you know, essentially put the work into to learn that stuff. It's easier just to kind of throw some hate on some stuff. So,
yeah. Well, and I think, you know, and we got to wrap up here quick, but I think, mentorship is a word that you and I talk about a lot, you know,
Huge. And
you know, I know that you reached out to me initially and it turned into, you know, some sort of me mentoring
too.
You, but at the same time, like the conversations that we have together, it's like, it's a two-way street. You know, I worked with DJ Sackman and got to spend time in New York City and Chris Brickley was around when he was still with the Knicks. And another guy, Micah Lancaster, and Micah has gotten categorized as, you know, and he's done some stuff with Dev Williams in the lab and talking about there's a Twitter bully. I mean, he's just awful that rips on people. And Mike has gotten labeled as a scammer. And so Dev has taken him on podcasts and like, hey, let's talk about this. And I'll be honest, Micah, the way Micah does some things, there are a lot of times where I'm like, hey, listen, man, that's not for me. But what I will say is that Micah is an incredible basketball mind. He does an incredible job. And I know for a fact that everything that he does has a purpose to it. So, I mean, Shane, you might do something. And I'm like, you know what? I don't really like that, but I understand why you're doing it. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just maybe not my cup of tea.
Right.
And so, from a mentorship standpoint, understanding Micah, understanding DJ, understanding guys like Andrew Moran, who does an awesome job down in Miami, or Tyler Ralph in Texas, or Jordan Lawley in California, guys like that, where you're watching this stuff and you're like, hey, you know, I like this. I don't like this, you know, whatever it is, but thinking for yourself, but also understanding like, hey, these guys have a purpose and there's stuff to be learned and, and gained from watching it. So, you got anything else?
No, that's it, man. We got to get back on soon.
No, I appreciate you joining us. This has been awesome. Can you let everybody know where they can find you online with Twitter and Instagram?
Yep. Twitter, Instagram is the same. Hennen, H-E-N-N-E-N underscore workouts. Just trying to post as much content as I can. Stuff that I'm doing, stuff that I see in games.
Yep. And then if you are in the South Dakota area, Sioux Falls area, you can connect with Shane at the Pentagon. And then one more plug, your wife.
Yeah.
Has Rachel has a new gig going on. Tell us about that.
Yep. So she has a cycle studio here in Sioux Falls, and you know, being a little bit biased, I do believe in cycling and how great it is, because I got some bad ankles and knees and stuff, and that's the one thing that feels good. It feels really good. So Pulse Cycle Studio, give that a follow if you're in Sioux Falls. Let me know. Just reach out to Pulse. Let's get you in there, get a good workout in.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on. We will talk soon.
Yes, sir.
That was Shane Hennen, basketball coordinator at the Sanford Pentagon in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. You know, I think the first part of that interview made a lot of basketball trainers and coaches jealous when he said he has access to 9 courts and the beautiful arena court. You know, I was fortunate enough when I coached at Minnesota State Moorhead to play a couple conference tournament games in that facility. I've gone out there and run a camp with Shane recently. He's got a beautiful facility, and I know that his name is going to continue to grow. He was able to establish kind of a new sort of training community in the Sioux Falls area and in South Dakota. It's been fun having him around me, helping with my workouts, but also talking to high school coaches and players in Minnesota that recognize his name and have been complimentary to the stuff that he's put online. So we want to say thank you to Shane for coming on, and we're looking forward to our next episode. Back to the drawing board. Have a great day.